Thank you, Mariah and Andrew. We're good. We appreciate it. Hope you can do it again sometime soon. One thing I forgot to announce is that the Sabbath after the feast, October the 2nd, we will have a service here. Not everybody will be back. I will not be back. We can't get back until the following Tuesday. But there will be a service here as normal. So if you want any, if you have any questions about it, just ask Mike Joseph. I was struck by something when I was watching BBC America's news on Thursday evening. It lasts an hour, but I only watched the first 30 minutes. But in that first 30 minutes, there were six segments, if you like. And I'll read you all six, and then you can tell me what the commonality is, or I'll tell you what the commonality is. The first thing was the Gainesville, Florida church pastor who was threatening to burn Korans today. The second item of news was the end of Ramadan, and it focused on how the United States treats Muslims. That was the second item of news. Then the third item of news was from Russia, of a bomb blast in Russia that killed seven. The bomb was planted by Islamic militants. The fourth item of news was from Somalia, where a suicide bomber tried to kill a politician at the airport in Mogadishu. The fifth item of news was from Afghanistan, and the fact that it's becoming more difficult for Allied soldiers to deal with the problems there. And the sixth item of news was from Iraq and the difficulty of forming a government because you've got Shia, you've got Sunni, and you've also got the Kurds, and all three do not get along. So after six items, I gave up. There may have been more, but you know, those six, the commonality is summed up in one word, Islam. Every single one of those problems was about the Muslim world, or issues related to Islam. Today is the ninth anniversary of 9/11. 10 years ago, few Americans knew anything about Islam and few cared. But suddenly, Islam was brought to prominence. I've got a book at home on the Islamic Antichrist that mentions that immediately after September the 11th, Muslims in the United States thought they'd have to go into hiding. They thought that what happened on September the 11th has set back Islam in the United States for decades, and that their freedoms would be taken away and people would not accept them. Instead, the reverse happened. Within 3 months, sales of the Quran were up so much that the printing press that prints Qurans in this country could not keep up with the demand. Sales of the Bible went up for a few weeks, but within about 6 weeks, the sales of the Bible were down again, back to the normal level. But the Quran has been in big demand ever since. And the number of converts to Islam has been in the tens of thousands just in this country since September the 11th. And I've forgotten the figure, but something like two-thirds of all converts are of African descent. But there are quite a few white converts as well. One of our neighbors, her daughter, converted to Islam. So you do get more and more people converting to Islam. It is the world's fastest growing religion. In fact, there's only one continent where Islam is not growing, and that's Africa. Africa is the only continent where Christianity is growing. And Muslims are actually leaving Islam and becoming Christians, mostly Pentecostals. And we've got one of our pastors in Ghana, was a former Muslim. And he's an interesting person to talk to about Islam, and that's where I get quite a bit of my information from, because all of his family are still Muslims, and he does occasionally see some of them. Let's look at what's happened in the last 9 years. You know, you think back to 2001, September the 11th, 19 men staged an attack that immediately killed 3,000 people, but led also to the deaths of over 6,000 U.S. troops and thousands of troops from other countries. It's totally changed everything. It didn't just end on that one day. But since then, of course, other things have happened. And it's left us broke. We fought major wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Plus, we have troops leading counterinsurgency conflicts in Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, and Indonesia. So we're effectively fighting Islam in at least six different countries. Not fighting Islam, I shouldn't say that. They constantly make the point that we're not at war with Islam. But because of this problem, we have troops in six different countries fighting in different conflicts. Ted Koppel was on the BBC News program, and he made the statement. I was surprised that he said this, and I thought it was very perceptive. He said, you know, from Al-Qaeda's point of view, they've won. Osama bin Laden must feel very pleased with himself because they've won. That was his comment. I thought it was kind of bold to say on an American news program. But he said, just face the facts here. They humiliated us before the whole world on September the 11th. They dragged us into conflicts, which are increasingly seen by Muslims around the world as a conflict between the Christian West and Islam. Now, the President of the United States and his predecessor have both made the comment that we're not at war with Islam, but the perception amongst many Muslims is that there is a war between Christian America, or the West, which is Christian in their minds, and Islam. And, of course, the biggest single thing, it's left us absolutely bankrupt. And, they brought down the Soviet Union. I think I've shared with you before that Osama bin Laden's followers claimed that he had a dream, just like Muhammad had a dream. Muhammad had a dream in the 600s, and in his dream it was revealed to him that his followers would bring down the two greatest empires in the world at that time, Byzantium and Persia. And they did. Now, after he was dead, not while he was alive. But they brought down Persia and they brought down Byzantium. And Osama bin Laden's followers claimed that he had a similar dream, that his followers would bring down the two greatest empires in the world, the Soviet Union and the United States. And they did bring down the Soviet Union in 1991. The fact that the Soviets were defeated in Afghanistan led directly to the fall of the Soviet Union about 18 months later. And their feeling is that they will also bring down the United States. And, the United States, the big problem is money, that we are broke as a country. And as a result of that, there will be an economic collapse. That is what their thinking is. So Ted Koppel brought out all of this in his interview on BBC America. And I thought it was an interesting interview. And it's an interesting perspective. When it comes to the Gainesville pastor and the burning of Korans, let's think of the significance for a moment, because those Korans were supposed to be burned today. I think it's kind of on hold for a while. Maybe they can't get enough Korans because the printing press can't keep up with it. I don't know. I've got a copy of the Koran at home. It's very difficult to read, by the way. It's extremely difficult to read it. To me, the most significant thing is this, over the past 9 years, is that Islam has gained a major hold in the United States, a major foothold. Salman Rushdie, who was a Muslim, he was brought up a Muslim, is a famous author, and he wrote a book in 1988 called The Satanic Verses, which was a parody on Muhammad. And the book led to him being the subject of a fatwa, which is a decree from the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. And the decree said that anybody who kills Salman Rushdie is doing God a favor, doing Allah a favor. And therefore, it was an open invitation to Muslims everywhere to kill Salman Rushdie. So he was immediately put under 24/7 police protection. And he remained that way for about 12 years. And, when this happened, a lot of libraries removed the book. And before they did, I checked it out myself. And I remember, just by page 2, I was offended by what he wrote. because what he said about Abraham was really quite distasteful. And the book also was very difficult to read. So I could see why they were upset. But if you say anything against Islam, of course, you know, that will go against you. And Salman Rushdie was brought up a Muslim. He's one of the very few Muslims in the Western world that have converted. Actually, Salman Rushdie is an atheist now, but he left Islam. And that's very, very rare. In fact, I remember about 10 years ago reading a book called The 100, which was actually about the 100 people in the West who have converted to Christianity from Islam. That's how few it is. The number of people converting to Islam is more than 100 a day. But this book was about the 100 that have converted from Islam. It's very few. And one reason for that is because anybody who leaves the Islamic religion, the instruction is in Islamic teachings that he should be killed by his family. And this happens a great deal. You often read about that in the British newspapers. There's a lot of Muslims live there. And if a girl, for example, gets involved with a non-Muslim boy and wants to, you know, leave the faith, then she will be killed by the parents or by an elder brother who will do that. So the first thing I think that we've seen is that Islam has gained a major foothold in the U.S. But I think it's important to realize, too, that Islam has gained an even bigger foothold in Europe. In France, for example, all the time that, you know, I could remember for about 40 years, the most common name given to boys every year was Pierre. Now the most common name given to boys is Muhammad, because the Muslims have a much higher birth rate than the whites do. They do not practice birth control, and this is one reason why their numbers are increasing at a very rapid rate. Another thing I think which is of great significance is, again, in the last 9 years, the West is on the defensive. Muslims are calling the shots all the time. They dictate the terms of debate. Even with this issue of the burning of the Qurans, for example, when the Muslims are interviewed on television, on the news, they will say, well, you know, the American Constitution guarantees freedom of religion. This is something that goes back right to the beginning of the United States. And so, therefore, we are entitled to build mosques wherever we want to. In other words, they use our freedoms to justify what they're doing. And we are always on the defensive. Then I think point number four on that is that the clash of civilizations is ever closer. I was trying to get a hold of an article by Ayan Hirsi Ali. You can look this up in the Wall Street Journal if you can access their archive. She wrote about a month ago. She is one of those rare people who was a Muslim and changed. She actually grew up in Somalia. She wrote her biography. She grew up in Somalia where, as a girl, I think of the age of 6, she was circumcised and abused by her father and brothers and so on. And she finally got away. She got out of Somalia and got to Holland. And eventually in Holland, with Dutch citizenship, she ended up in the Dutch parliament. But then she had falsified something, and so she got kicked out. And she's ended up in the United States. And she wrote this article for the Wall Street Journal about the inevitability of a clash of civilizations. She is no longer a Muslim. In fact, she actually is Neil Ferguson's partner. Neil Ferguson is, I think, the greatest historian today. And, her thinking is very conservative, just like him. Not conservative enough, though. They're not actually married. But anyway, she's wrote this article on the inevitability of a clash of civilizations, which is what we believe the Bible is saying is going to happen. And, of course, this thing right now with the burning of the Qurans could lead to that clash of civilizations. If the Qurans are burned, then you're going to have demonstrations right across the Muslim world and people killed. It's already happened this week in anticipation of the burnings of the Qurans. And, the consequences could be horrendous. Look at Daniel chapter 11. Daniel chapter 11 is a chapter that deals with the king of the north and the king of the south. And I think it's appropriate on this day, September the 11th, To look back and see some of the lessons that we've learned over the past few years and to realize where we are now, because September the 11th was not the end. To paraphrase Winston Churchill, September the 11th was not the end. It was not even the beginning of the end, but it was perhaps the end of the beginning. In other words, September the 11th was the beginning of our problems, not the end of our problems with Islam. And when we look back in decades to come, it will be seen that way. One man from Iran, I've forgotten his name now, but he writes regularly for different publications. He was interviewed some time ago on a television news program. And he made the comment, he said, people think September the 11th was the start of this conflict with Islam. And he said, that is not true. He said, the conflict goes back to 1979. And that's when, as he put it, that's when World War III started, 1979. That was the year that the biggest single failure of American foreign policy happened since World War II. And that was the fall of the Shah of Iran. The Shah of Iran was pro-Western. He tried to modernize his country. But he could be very stern, as a result of which there was a lot of opposition to his rule. And eventually he was overthrown in 1979 and replaced by the Ayatollahs. And the kingdom of Iran became the theocratic republic of Iran, led by Muslim clerics. And so it became a very fanatical Islamic country. And this was a major failing of American foreign policy. It was a disaster, frankly. And, of course, it's led to all these problems, including September the 11th, just a few years ago. And it really is only the beginning. This is a conflict that, as Tony Blair said in an interview just a few days ago when his book came out, which sounds like interesting. I've ordered a copy of it. But, Tony Blair made the comment that, this could go on for decades. This is going to be the conflict that is going to dominate all of our lives for a long time, the conflict with militant Islam. Daniel 11 is a chapter that deals with the King of the North and the King of the South. These were two major powers, that one was to the north of Jerusalem, one was to the south of Jerusalem. And these two powers existed in the 4th and 3rd and 2nd centuries. And it's a very detailed prophecy about how those two powers would influence the people of Judah, the Jews. And basically, every time the king of the north went to war with the king of the south, or vice versa, they would trample upon the Jews. And this was prophesied in Daniel 11. And it's very detailed. The prophecy was written in the 6th century B.C., but it was fulfilled in the 4th century B.C. with the death of Alexander the Great, and went right through the 3rd and the 2nd centuries, right up to the time of Antiochus Epiphanes, who desecrated the temple in 168 B.C. So it's a major prophecy which was fulfilled in great detail. But then suddenly it comes to an end. And then in verse 40, it starts talking about the king of the north and the king of the south again. At the time of the end, the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and with many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Now, why do we have this great big gap from roughly 168 B.C. Until the time of the end? And the reason for that gap is because there was no independent Jewish nation from the time of the Roman Empire right up until 1948. And then at the time of the end, we see the king of the south and the king of the north become relevant again. Now, it's not going to be the same two dynasties that ruled in the 4th and the 3rd and the 2nd century B.C., but we are going to see two major powers again, one to the north of Jerusalem and one to the south of Jerusalem, just as you did over 2,000 years ago. But now we believe that what we're looking at here is the king of the south will be a great Islamic power to the south of Jerusalem, maybe led by Egypt, and the king of the north, the revived Roman Empire. That has been our traditional belief. That's what we believe is coming. And this is the clash of civilizations. As the king of the south, it says, shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. So the king of the north has this great military machine here. But the king of the south is the one that pushes against the king of the north. That's the term that is used in the original King James. It shall push against him. And this is what we've been seeing for the past few decades, that Islam has been pushing against the West. Pushing is not the same as an outright conflict. But gradually over the past 20 or 30 years, Muslims have been gaining a bigger foothold in Western countries, especially in Europe, more so in Europe than here, but here as well. And, you know, of course, this all led to September the 11th. But since then, of course, they've become even more powerful and have become a major force in Western Europe. In fact, Colonel Gaddafi of Libya, the leader of Libya, he's been president for over 40 years, Gaddafi was visiting Italy. And he said just a few days ago, he said he believes that Italy will be the first Muslim country in Europe, the first Muslim country in Western Europe, because Albania is Muslim and so is Bosnia. But the first Muslim country in Europe is what he said. Now, just think about that for a moment. Italy is where the Roman Catholic Church is. That's where their headquarters is. And Italy's always been Catholic. And here's Gaddafi saying, Italy is going to be the first Muslim country in Western Europe. And coinciding with his arrival in Italy, thousands of Italian women announced their conversion to Islam. You know, you've got to think, why? I mean, Islam is notorious for the way it treats its women very badly. Women are a possession in Islam. So, you know, why are all these women converting to Islam? I don't know. You'd have to Google it and try to find out. But when Gaddafi arrived in Italy, he was greeted by all these women, and they had all converted to Islam. And, you know, it's obviously something that's disturbing a lot of people. Now, you know, Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40, when it says the king of the south shall push against the king of the north, you know, I think that something much bigger than September the 11th is going to happen. In fact, Tony Blair said in his interview, he said, what everybody is waiting for and is inevitable is, he says, a nuclear device will be set off by terrorists somewhere in the Western world. And that could happen any day. It might be 10 years away, but it could happen at any time. And if a nuclear device was set off, you know, that would have a far greater impact than the burning of Korans, and that's going to have a big impact. But a nuclear device, can you imagine, if it was in the United States, can you imagine the reaction of Americans to that? If it's in Western Europe, imagine the reaction. You know, that would lead to the clash that is prophesied here between these different forces. And that was Tony Blair's biggest concern. And he said, this is why we have to do something about Iran. Iran's trying to get nuclear weapons, and they will then help terrorist groups to use them, because Iran backs terrorist groups. Hezbollah, for example, Hamas, are both supported by Iran. So they would give their nuclear technology to these groups. And he said, this is the reason why we have to stop the Iranians. But, you know, he also said, this was interesting, he said in the interview, he said, a man came up to me the other day, and he said, well, you know, so what if the Iranians get nuclear weapons? What difference would it make? He said, you know, surely they could see that if they use them, then the West will attack them. And, you know, this is the way we think in the West, because we have a logical thought process. But that is not the way that they think in Iran. It's not the way that other nations think, because, you know, a lot of nations are much more emotional. And when it comes to the Muslims, they're very, very emotional. And the Iranians believe that the Mahdi is coming. Their Messiah, the Islamic Messiah, is coming. And they believe that they've got to stir up as much trouble in the world as possible in order to facilitate the coming of the Mahdi. So if they get nuclear weapons, they will use them. And that's absolutely certain. And everybody in the neighborhood knows that. The Iranians are Shia Muslims. Many of the other countries, most of the other countries, are Sunni Muslims. The Egyptians, the Saudi Arabians, the Turks, and one of the others, I've forgotten who, four countries are looking into acquiring their own nuclear weapons because they're afraid that the Iranians will attack them. The Shiites will attack the Sunnis. And, you know, that is certainly possible. And, in fact, even this prophecy in Daniel 11, could tie in with that. Look at Acts chapter 17, because here is a fundamental error that has been committed here. You know, why did we not have this problem before? You know, all of you here who are at school, and some of you are still at school, have grown up in a period of political correctness, where at school multiculturalism has been promoted a great deal. It has been a foundation of our educational system in the past 40 years. But it was not like that before, and I will come to that in a moment. But look at Acts chapter 17 and verse 26. It says here that, this is the Apostle Paul speaking, that God has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, and has determined their preappointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings. You know, God actually separated the races and the religions, the ethnic groups. But, of course, man, and Satan is influencing man in this thinking, has tried to mix all the different groups. And yet, when you look at history, you realize, when it comes to religions especially, that's just not going to work. You look at the Balkans, for example, in southeastern Europe. And, 10 years ago, you had a number of wars in the Balkans. Basically, you had three ethnic groups, which also were three different religions. Islam, you had Roman Catholicism, the Croats were Catholics, the Bosnians were Muslims, and then the Serbs were Orthodox. And those three hated each other. And they had different conflicts, and tens of thousands of people were killed. And finally they got exhausted, and now there is peace. But there'll be more conflict in the future. In fact, World War I in 1914 started because of problems in the Balkans between those ethnic groups. But in the 1990s, we were back in the Balkans again with more problems between those same ethnic groups. So why is it that we think in the United States that we're going to avoid that? That somehow we can mix all these religions together and everything's going to be hunky-dory, as the Australians say? It's not going to happen. You know, our immigration policies have fundamentally altered the country and will continue to do so. In the 7 years after September the 11th, I read this in the Wall Street Journal some time ago. In the 7 years after September the 11th, America took in 10 million more people. That's roughly 1.5 million a year. Half of them were legal, half of them illegal. Now, when you consider that one-fifth of all the people in the world are Muslims, that means out of that 1.5 million, roughly 300,000 were Muslims. The census does not ask, the immigration department does not ask your religion when you move into the country. So roughly we let in 300,000 a year. And they have a much higher birth rate than white Americans do. So you can see how the numbers are increasing. Look at Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. This is a chapter about the end time, and what does it tell us? In verse 7, it says, "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom." What's the difference between a nation and a kingdom? You look at the Greek here, when it refers to kingdom against kingdom, it's talking about a political entity, a country ruled by a king, going to war against another king. Or a president against a president. The same thing could be a fulfillment of that. When it talks about nation against nation, the Greek word there is ethnos, which means ethnic group. So Jesus Christ is saying that at the time of the end, this is going to be a major problem, ethnic conflict. And all these different ethnic groups, and often ethnic groups are separated also by religion, which is an added complication. This is going to be the bulk of the conflict that you're going to see at the end. But we cannot see it clearly because in our educational system, we emphasize multiculturalism. And the result is we can't think straight. The way that many of our politicians have been talking the past week or so over this issue of the burning of the Korans, you would think that the founding fathers of the United States in the 1780s, when they were drawing up our Constitution, you would think that they were very concerned to make sure that Muslims had the right to build mosques here, there, and everywhere. You listen to what some of the people are saying on our television news programs. They're saying, well, you know, even the president are saying things like, well, you know, the founding fathers guaranteed freedom of religion. Every group, you know, can build their own church or mosque. And the implication is that this goes right back to the 1780s. You know when the first convert to Islam was made in the United States? Now, let me, before I answer that, I'll tell you that there were Muslims in the 1700s. They were brought over as slaves from West Africa. Some of those people were Muslims, okay? But the first recorded convert to Islam of a white American was in 1892, okay? His name, if you want it, was Alexander Russell Webb. This is in a book on Muslims in America. And he was actually in the Philippines working for the U.S. government, for the State Department, at a time when the Philippines was ruled by Spain. The Philippines did have a lot of Muslims, and he converted to Islam while he was over there. And because he converted to Islam, he had to resign from government service because the United States would not have tolerated a Muslim in government service at that time. Islam was considered a pagan religion. Now, we are being told now that the founding fathers of the United States, all of whom were Bible-influenced Protestants, okay, were being told that they were concerned to make sure that Muslims had the right to build mosques, which is just totally untrue, very misleading. But who's going to question these things when they hear it every night on the news? To understand the attitude, you have to understand the mentality at that time, and you know that means reading material that was written at that time. The attitude was that the people who founded the United States, the people who came from England in the 1600s, for example, they were very much influenced by the Bible. The Bible was to them the Word of God. In fact, the first settlement in Jamestown, you know, when Pocahontas was taken back to England, the chief of her tribe, or one of the elders of the tribe, wanted to go back with her. And, you know, he was asked by one of the Englishmen, well, why do you want to go back to England? He said, I want to see where this God lives that you talk about all the time. You know, they were filled with the Bible. And at that time, the King James translation came out in 1611. They were very much influenced by the scriptures. And they believed that people who did not follow this book were, and I'll use the term they would have used, primitive savages. Maybe they shouldn't have used that term. But this was their thinking at the time, that all the other religions were pagan. They would not even tolerate Roman Catholicism, which they considered a religion of ignorance and superstition. And in fact, Jamestown was actually built just around the bend off the coast. If you go there, you can see this. And it was built specifically there because they wanted to protect themselves from the Catholic powers, France and Spain, that had very big navies at the time. And they knew that as Protestants, if they fell into the hands of the Catholics, they would be put to death at that time. And so that's why they built Jamestown where they built it. They also built it where they built it because they wanted to protect themselves from the Native Americans inland. So there was only one spot where they could actually build Jamestown in that whole area. And it was built there to protect themselves not only from the Native Americans, the savages as they would have called them, but also from the Roman Catholics from Europe that would have also caught them. So And in fact, if you read, there's a book called The Three Faces of Royal America by an American historian about the colonial period. And he mentions that throughout the colonial period, The raison d'etre of the American colonies, what bound them together more than anything, was anti-Catholicism, because they were trying to start a new world away from the old religion over in Europe that had not given them the freedom to read the Bible. And the Bible was the foundational book in our educational system. Long into the formation of the United States, this was the major book used in American schools. And all of this is documented. You can read all about it, but you're not going to hear about it from Matt Lauer or Diane Sawyer or any of these other people that are well-versed in liberalism, which is, anti-biblical and, very irreligious. Winston Churchill wrote in his book, The River War, which was written around the year 1900, I'm not sure exactly when. Winston Churchill was in the last cavalry charge the British military had in 1898 in a war in the Sudan, where we now are very concerned about Islamic fundamentalism. At the time that Winston Churchill was there, the Muslims were following a man they called the Mahdi. They thought he was their Messiah. They were wrong. Now they still believe the Mahdi is coming, a new Messiah. But in 1898, the British dealt with this problem of the Mahdi in the only way that you can deal with a problem like that, and that is to wipe them all out. And Winston Churchill wrote this about Islam in his book, The River War. Now, this is very politically incorrect, so if it's going to offend you, you better go out. But this is what he wrote. How dreadful are the curses which Islam lays on its votaries, on the nations that support it. Besides the fanatical frenzy, which is as dangerous in a man as hydrophobia in a dog, rabies in a dog, there is a fearful, fatalistic apathy. Improvident habits, slovenly systems of agriculture, sluggish methods of commerce, and insecurity of property exist wherever the followers of the Prophet rule or live. This is why their countries are so poor. A degraded sensualism deprives this life of its grace and refinement, the next of its dignity and sanctity. The fact that in Islam, in Islamic law, every woman must belong to some man as his absolute property, either as a child, a wife, or a concubine, must delay the final extinction of slavery until the faith of Islam has ceased to be a great power among men. At the time, in the 1800s, Britain was very much opposed to slavery, and the Royal Navy had the authority to stop any ship and check that there were no slaves. But as Churchill said, slavery will not die out until Islam dies out. Individual Muslims may show splendid qualities, he says. Thousands become the brave and loyal soldiers of the Queen. England ruled India, and there were a lot of Muslims in the army. All know how to die. But the influence of the religious paralyzes the social development of those who follow it. No stronger retrograde force exists in the world than Islam. This is, very powerful and very much against what people think now. Far from being moribund, Islam is a militant and proselytizing faith. It has already spread throughout Central Africa, raising fearless warriors at every step. And were it not that Christianity is sheltered in the strong arms of science, the civilization of modern Europe might fall, as fell the civilization of ancient Rome. Just two paragraphs from the book, The River War. And, he hits another point here. He says that Christianity is sheltered in the strong arms of reason, basically, is what he's saying. But, of course, Christianity does not exist anymore, really, in Europe. There are very few people who claim to be Christians. And as a result of that, Europe is not able to defend itself against Islam anymore, because people just can't think straight, because they don't have that Christian base. And, of course, that's happened to a great extent here as well. Let's look at some other scriptures. Genesis chapter 16 is another good place to go. Genesis chapter 16. Islam is going to be the major problem confronting us in the Western world for the foreseeable future. And, you know, those who are young here, this will be the defining conflict of your age, unless Jesus Christ returns shortly, which I hope he does, because he's the only one who can sort this out, frankly, and I'll show you that later on. Now, first of all, realize not all Muslims are Arabs, and not all Arabs are Muslims, though most are. Muhammad was an Arab. He believed the Arabs were the descendants of Ishmael. Genesis 6, chapter 16 tells us about Ishmael. Now, Sarah, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. So Sarah said to Abraham, "See now, the Lord has restrained me from bearing children. Please, go into my maid. Perhaps I shall obtain children by her." And Abraham heeded the voice of Sarah. Then Sarah, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, and gave her to her husband Abraham to be his wife, after Abraham had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan. So he went in to Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Then Sarah said to Abraham, "My wrong be upon you. I gave my maid into your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, I became despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between you and me." Anyway, the child that she gave birth to was Ishmael. And later on, Abraham's wife Sarah had a child, and his name was Isaac. And of course, when Isaac came along, he was the preferred child. Ishmael was not, because Ishmael was the child of the handmaid. And so eventually, Hagar and Ishmael were banished. They were sent away from Abraham's home. And then in verse 11, the angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man." This is the prophecy regarding Ishmael. And remember, the Arabs, they've intermarried with other tribes as well. There's a lot of tribes mentioned in the book of Genesis. There's a lot of tribes have intermarried, but the Ishmaelites, are still there in the Arab lineage. And, Muhammad believed that they were descended from Ishmael. "You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. He shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." Again, a very accurate prophecy regarding the Arabs. In fact, even early visitors to the Arab territories, like in the Byzantine Empire in the 500s and so on around that time, they wrote about how wild the people were in Arabia even before they converted to Islam. That's where Islam comes from, the area of Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina. In fact, it started in Medina. And this is where it came from. And of course, this temperament, this wild man status, this description here, has been so descriptive of Islam throughout the generations. Other countries, even like Indonesia, which have become Islamic, have been influenced by this. People can be very emotional. I mean, it's interesting. There's a threat of the burning of Qurans, and you've got people going berserk. Tens of thousands of people around the world demonstrating, killing people, whoever they can find to kill. The reaction, really, frankly, is childish. It's immature. If somebody disagrees with you, you don't go and kill them just because they disagree. But in some cultures, you do. And that is the reaction that you've got in many parts of the world. If, for example, we had a guy on the south side, a Pastor Jones on the south side, burning copies of the Good News or our other literature, would we all go crazy? I don't think so. We'd probably meet here and just think, oh, they're just stupid over there, Well, we wouldn't go crazy over it. But, that's what you're seeing as a reaction of what's... the possible burning of these Qurans. Now, the primary conflict, of course, is not the one between the United States and Al-Qaeda. The primary conflict is the one between the Palestinians and the Jews, which goes back directly to Abraham. If Abraham had never gone in to Hagar, then you wouldn't have this problem in the Middle East today. And a lot of people know that. They know that's what it goes back to. Just because we in the Christian West have ceased to understand these things, as we've turned away from the Bible as a nation, doesn't mean that others do not understand these things. People in the Middle East understand them very well, and the Muslims in particular do understand them. So the primary conflict goes back to Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael. The conflict has the potential to destroy the planet. Tony Blair said that. Didn't use those words as such, but he said the conflict has the potential to bring down the end of civilization, or bring about the end of civilization. Matthew 24 and verse 22. This is exactly what Jesus Christ said. This is what he warned about in verse 22. And this chapter deals with the time of the end. He says in verse 22, unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. So Jesus Christ returns to stop man from destroying himself. And only Jesus Christ can put this conflict between Islam and Christianity and Judaism. Only he can put an end to that conflict, and I'll show you why. Before we get there, look at a couple of other scriptures. Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21 and verse 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Here's Jesus Christ again, talking about the time of the end. Jerusalem is the main focus. 100 years ago, that was not the case. In Churchill's generation, for example, the Middle East was a backwater of no relevance whatsoever. Britain was the major power at the time. And in a book which is a very detailed history of the Middle East at this particular time, in the early decades of the 20th century, that point is made. Before World War I, it was a backwater and of no relevance to anybody. But Jesus Christ said that at the time of the end, Jerusalem would be the very focus of conflict. And of course, what changed everything was the establishment of the nation of Israel in 1948. And that had to happen even for Daniel 11, verse 40, the king of the north, the king of the south, for that prophecy to take effect. The Jews had to have their own country back again. And so Jesus Christ said here, this is the center of Bible prophecy. This is where it's all going to happen, in the Middle East. In verse 22, for these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. Verse 24, they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem shall be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And there will be signs in the sun, in the moon, and in the stars, and on the earth, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring. So all these things happening climatically as well. Men's hearts failing them from fear and the expectation of those things which are coming on the earth. For the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. Now when these things begin to happen, look up and lift up your heads, because your redemption draws near. Your salvation will come at the time that all of this is going on. Then he spoke to them a parable. Look at the fig tree and all the trees. When they are already budding, you see and know for yourselves that summer is now near. So you also, when you see these things happening, know that the kingdom of God is near. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all things take place. So, it's all going to happen very quickly when it happens. And it's all tied in with this problem with Islam and the conflict with the Jews and involving the United States and other Western nations as well. Look at Daniel chapter 9. There's another interesting prophecy. Daniel chapter 9, this is the 70 weeks prophecy, which is a very detailed prophecy about Jesus Christ. But in the 70 weeks prophecy, there is also a prophecy regarding the time of Christ's return. And in verse 27, it says, he shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. Now, this verse contains a lot. Right now, there are no sacrifices, no offerings taking place in Jerusalem. And remember, Jerusalem is the center of Bible prophecy. But there are no sacrifices right now. So we see from this that the sacrifices are going to be reinstated. Right now, the Israelis could not do that because it would trigger off World War III with the Palestinians and with the wider Arab and Muslim world. This can only be done by an international agreement with a peace treaty. And that's also what this verse says. He shall confirm a covenant with many for 1 week. And this passage is referring to the Roman Empire of old, 2,000 years ago, and a revived Roman Empire. So here is a treaty that enables the Jews to start the sacrifices in Jerusalem. You know, the way things are, that can only happen if Jerusalem becomes an international city. And it's interesting that right now you have the greater prospect of a treaty between the Palestinians and the Jews than at any other time, partly because President Obama has turned against the nation of Israel. So there is pressure there on the Israelis. Secondly, the Israeli prime minister is the most conservative prime minister they've had in about 30 years, Benjamin Netanyahu. And a conservative could probably get away with a peace deal better than a liberal could, because everybody would be afraid the liberal was compromising too much. But the pressure is on Israel to agree to a peace treaty. And the Palestinians as well are ready to talk. If you get a peace treaty, who will guarantee the peace? It cannot be the United States, because the United States has been too one-sided. But it could be Europe. And, you know, the Europeans are involved in this as well. But it says there shall be a covenant, a peace agreement, for 1 week. That's 7 years, actually. A day symbolizes a year. So 7 years. But halfway through the week, in the middle of the week, in other words, after 3.5 years, the peace treaty will collapse. There cannot be peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It's impossible, because they both want the same piece of land. The Palestinians want Israel. And the Israelis are not just going to cease to exist to let them have what they want. So you're never going to have peace. A peace treaty can be imposed by outside powers, but it won't last for very long. And that's what this verse would suggest. So let's have a look at some other passages here. Zechariah, we'll finish in Zechariah. So if you can find it, you can stay there. Zechariah chapter 12. Zechariah chapter 12, beginning in verse 1. The burden of the word of the Lord against Israel. Thus says the Lord, who stretches out the heavens, lays the foundation of the earth, and forms the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah and Jerusalem. You know, the nations are so desperate to destroy the Jewish nation that they don't think straight. They're drunk. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. You know, I think that's true. The Islamic countries, they just hate the fact that Jews are in control of Jerusalem. And so it's a heavy stone to them. It weighs heavily on them. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all nations of the earth are gathered against it. In that day, says the Lord, I will strike every horse with confusion and its rider with madness. I will open my eyes on the house of Judah and will strike every horse of the peoples with blindness. You know, so when nations attack Jerusalem, those nations will suffer. In verse 9, it shall be in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem has been fought over more than any other city in the history of the world, many times throughout history. So a lot of people reading this would say, well, that happened 2,500 years ago, or it happened in the first century with the Romans, or it happened in the second century with the Romans. It's happened so often. And then the Muslims took Jerusalem in the 600, 687 or something. And then, of course, the Turks took it in 1517. There's been so many conflicts there. All of that must refer to the past. But Zechariah 14 shows it's actually talking about the future. And this is where we'll finish in Zechariah chapter 14. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day his feet, Christ's feet, will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west, making a very large valley. Half of the mountain shall move toward the north, and half of it toward the south. This has never happened before in history. Christ walked on the Mount of Olives, but the Mount of Olives was not split in two. So this is still in the future. And it's actually a millennial prophecy. And you see that when you get further down in this particular passage. You go down to verse 16, for example. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. So this is still future. It's the time when the Messiah returns, when Jesus Christ returns to this earth. And it says specifically in verse 18, if the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Egypt is a predominantly Muslim nation. And it's singled out here for a special mention. When Jesus Christ returns, they are going to have to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Not Ramadan, the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, I've heard so much on the TV news programs this week about how, you know, we must be tolerant towards Muslims. And, you know, I'm not in favor of burning Qurans. And when I meet Muslims, you know, I'm as nice as I can possibly be, okay? And that's the way you should be with everybody. But whenever they talk about tolerance, it makes me think of this passage. Because God is not tolerant towards false religion. And everybody's going to be forced to keep the holy days when Jesus Christ returns. Not just the Muslims, of course, but the people who are members of the mainstream Christian community will also have to keep the holy days, and the Jews will have to keep them with Jesus Christ involved in them instead of separately. So, you know, God is not tolerant when it comes to false religion. But whenever they talk on TV about us being tolerant, you know, we have to keep that in mind. But it's not until Jesus Christ returns and ends false religion that we're going to see an end to this conflict. It's not going to happen until then. So this is a problem that is insoluble. I do have to look at a couple of other scriptures. In Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 9, it does talk about the time when Christ returns, when the whole world will be full of the knowledge of the Lord. You know, that's not going to happen until Jesus Christ returns. Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, this is the very last scripture we'll look at. But I want to look at this because it's important to understand it. Because in this age of multiculturalism, it's often difficult to really see straight. Remember, multiculturalism is new. Political correctness is new. I am thankful that unlike my younger brothers, I actually went to school before political correctness in the 1950s and early 1960s. And so my schooling was much more conservative than what my younger, more degenerate brothers got later on. They can't think straight. Actually, they're pretty good, actually. They've turned out quite conservative in spite of what the schools tried to do to them. But It's very hard for those growing up today and going to school today with all this emphasis on multiculturalism and how all religions are equally valid and all religions preach peace, which is not true. If you look at terrorism in the world, I think it's 97.5% of all terrorist acts are committed by Muslims. It's only 2.5% not committed by Muslims. So, it's not true to say all religions are peaceful. But, understand that when they teach you these things at school, they're trying to lull you into a false state of security, when the reality is that we've got a major problem here, and it's going to get worse. And at some point, it will lead to conflict, major conflict. There's already conflict, but at some point, it will lead to conflict here as well as conflict over there. But there's one thing to understand and always keep in mind. In Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, it reminds us, there is salvation in no other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. Only through Jesus Christ can a person receive salvation. So other religions are not equally valid. Our ancestors knew that, which is why the founding fathers actually were intolerant of pagan religions. Not tolerant of them, as we're being led to believe now on our television news programs. Neither Islam nor Judaism recognize Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Christians do. And by the way, this is why when an imam leads a school assembly in prayer, you should not say amen at the end. Because the imam, at the end of the prayer, when he mentions Jesus Christ, he mentions Muhammad, mentions Moses as well. If you say amen to that, you are denying the divinity of Jesus Christ. Because Muslims do not believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah. They believe he was a prophet. And they believe that Muhammad was the greatest prophet. So therefore, if they mention in the prayer, and they do at the end, they will say in the name of Moses, and I think they say in the name of Isaac and Moses and Jesus Christ and Muhammad, they are saying effectively that they're all on a par. Muhammad was the greatest. And therefore, they're denying the divinity of Jesus Christ. But here in Acts chapter 4 and verse 12, we're taught that salvation is not possible except through Jesus Christ. And again, the Bible students in the past knew that, and it was a firmly held belief. And this is the reason why, missionaries were sent out by churches in the 19th century to convert the natives in different countries. The whole idea was they were lost unless they converted to Christianity. But of course now we're teaching people that it doesn't really matter, because you can get to heaven in any of these churches. Well, you don't go to heaven anyway. I think you know that. So, but that's the way it is. So anyway, that's the way things are. 9 years after September the 11th, this conflict is not over, and it's not getting any better. It's actually getting worse, and it's leading up to something much bigger, which is prophesied in the Bible, and it won't be resolved until Jesus Christ returns and puts an end to false religion. Only he can do that. Because, the Jews expect a Messiah for the first time. And many Christians believe a Messiah is coming for the second time. But Muslims also believe a Messiah is coming, the Islamic Messiah, the Mahdi. And it's only when the Messiah really does come that everybody can be set straight and understand who's right and who's wrong. I hope you'll all stay for the potluck. We're going to stay and we'll talk to you out there.